We are completing the series of sessions on tools development today with a session on the interactions that occur between the epithelium and mesenchyme. In the past few years, this topic has significantly grown, and at this time we really want to go over some of the material that we are now pretty much accepting as fact, while there are other areas where we really do not accept everything as fact yet, and so we will lightly brush on that, but I will make very clear that you don't have to know that stuff. So let's first again look at this particular diagram that you have seen before, and that diagram tells you that you have the situation where there is epithelium and mesenchyme. And the epithelium and mesenchyme, in a variety of different ectodermal derivatives, can have different kinds of interactions, but it is always an interaction. It is always an situation where you have something, whoops, Daisy, back here, where you have an interaction between ectoderm and mesenchyme. And it is the interaction and the continuation of the interaction that is critical, and as we will see, is particularly important in the tooth. Because as we go, you can have a thickened epithelium with a condensed mesenchyme below, and then the first possibility that you have to face is that the epithelium can grow in, as it does here, or it can grow out, as it does here. And what determines that? The next thing is, this particular structure can still lead to different structures like tooth, hair, or glands. And again, the question is why? And finally, of course, there are a whole series of changes that occur within the individual cells that we know as cytodifferentiation that lead to the actual structure that we call a tooth, a hair, or a gland. So these are conditions that we know a lot about, and we also know there are very many similarities, but there clearly are dissimilarities also, because if you didn't have dissimilarities, then everything would form either a gland or a hair or a tooth, but we have these very fine different specifications that get into different structures. So we have, in the case of a tooth, we have developmental interactions between the oral ectoderm, and this is oral, and the neurocrest-derived mesenchyme, and we call that ectomesenchyme. So whenever you see the word ectomesenchyme, that means that it's neurocrest-derived. The other term that is used for that is mesectoderm. So ectomesenchyme or mesectoderm are terms that are applied to the mesenchyme that is neurocrest-derived. And as you know, that is only true in the head, although trunk neurocrest has been shown to be able to make mesenchyme as well, but it doesn't normally do it. All right, what we've done so far is look at a series of different stages of development of tooth, and we started out with an initiation. We had a bud and a placoat, first a placoat, and then we had a bud, and then the next stage is what you're seeing here, cap stage, and then early bell stage, and finally late bell stage. And essentially, through the middle of the bell stage, you can say you have a process of morphodifferentiation. In the late bell stage, you start the process of cytodifferentiation. And again, I just want to remind you that this is a process that goes from incisal or occlusal to apical. So there is a gradient. And so we begin with apposition stage, and then during the eruption you have the formation of the root, and finally when the tooth emerges in the oral cavity and beyond, there will be attrition. So this is the real life cycle of one single tooth. Now, what we are particularly interested in for today is the period up to apposition stage. So we're going to look at the apposition stage and see how you get epithelial-mesenchymal interactions. Now, what exactly do these epithelial-mesenchymal interactions do? And I think it's important for you to realize, again, keeping in mind that gradient that I mentioned, that there are periods in which things mix. There are two possibilities, and these are two models that we can consider. One is known as the morphostatic model. This is not for you to remember. I just want you to intellectually understand the difference. The morphostatic model, which means that in the period up to a certain point, you have pure morphodifferentiation, and then after that, pure cytodifferentiation. And then there is another one where we have another model. So this is model number one. This is model number two. That during developmental time, you have a mixture of inductive and morphogenetic mechanisms. So I said that wrong. Let's start all over again. Okay? Let's cross this out. What I'm saying is that there is a period of induction. I was somewhere else with my head. Period of induction and period of morphodifferentiation. Over here, that is the correct thing. And here there is the second model indicates that it is alternating period of induction and morphodifferentiation. Now, why is that important? Because what it means is that if you first claim to have nothing but induction, and then nothing but morphodifferentiation. It means that all of the interactions occur first, and then the growth processes follow. But they are set in a certain way, in a certain amount of time, and really there is not that much variation, because what it says is, well, we're going to have this cusp, this cusp, this one here and here. And once these are set up, nothing else will change, and so all you have is now that it is going to form. In the morphodynamic model, the second model, what it says is, well, first you have induction leading to this cusp, and then we have some growth, and then you have two additional cusps, and they will grow a little bit more, and then there is a couple more cusps that develop, and that will grow some more. There's much more flexibility in that so-called morphodynamic stage. And what you really hear is that in the case of evolution, and this all goes back to evolution, that if you have a situation where you have these kinds of possibilities, no changes in inductive mechanisms, but do changes in morphogenetic mechanisms, what you really get is the same pattern, but because the induction has all taken place early on, and there was no change in that. And what you're getting is relatively minor changes in the final shape. If you think about major changes in the final shape, what you have is a situation where you have changes in the morphogenetic mechanisms, but they occur at the same time with the inductive pattern, and so you will end up with much larger differences in the final shape. So the concept that you have to think about, and that really is the one that most of us now accept, is that while you have morphodifferentiation, there are still areas of the tooth that are subject to inductive interactions leading to further development. Okay? So induction really occurs over a considerable amount of time. Now let's look at the sequence of developmental interactions. This was first published by a scientist in Helsinki, Dr. Whoa, are you not moving? Why not? Okay, to hell with you. The person that you will see the name of very frequently is Dr. Irma Thesleff. She is a scientist in Helsinki. And she has done really most of the serious work in this field. And in 1981, which is already quite a while ago, I mean, for you guys, it's pretty much a lifetime, I think, what you find is that she actually posed these series of sequential interactions between the ectomesenchyme, in this case here, and the oral epithelium. And what you found was, and what she found was, that there were a series of developmental interactions that occurred between these two tissues, and they alternated from one to the other. And so what you find is, and the first two we have already discussed, you first have, during the migration route, you have the pharyngeal endoderm, and as you know, the pharyngeal endoderm is necessary for the development of cartilage and of dental tissues. So the migration route provides input in the neurocrest cells that says, okay, you can move on to become ultimately dental committed mesenchyme. And then there is the second inductive interaction, that's from the oral epithelium. And as we now pretty much have accepted, the oral epithelium is producing fibroblast growth factor 8, which actually guides the cranial neurocrest cells to the area underneath the future placoid. So the movement of these neurocrest cells to the area of the placoid is most decidedly under the influence of oral ectoderm. That much we know now. And so these two, number one and number two, of these inductive interactions, which are from epithelium, pharyngeal epithelium and later oral epithelium, they change the neurocrest cells to determined dental mesenchyme. So at that point, once they arrive there, they are already set for a further development that will give rise to the different dental tissues. And at this time, when there is a determined dental mesenchyme, you now have an interaction that goes from the mesenchyme to the epithelium, which stimulates the epithelium to start growing into the underlying tissue. And so you have bud and later on you will have cap, that will be a little later. And what you find is that at this point there is a series, and 4 and 5 we just kind of assume are ongoing inductive interactions back and forth, very much like that morphodynamic model that I showed you. So these are just generic, okay? There are probably times n, multiple times, back and forth, back and forth. Then there comes a point where the enamel epithelium, and that is mostly the IEE as we know it, starts interacting with the dental papilla. And that is something that you have seen. The dental papilla cells now line up along the basal lamina and become odontoblasts. And now the odontoblasts, in turn, interact with the epithelium, and the epithelium now goes through a series of stages that goes from preameloblast to presecretory ameloblast to ameloblast. And again, we are thinking that it's not just the odontoblast, but that also the predentin has a role in that. So the picture that you're seeing here is one of dependency. Epithelium depends on mesenchymal signals. Mesenchyme depends on epithelial signals. Another thing that you have to realize, and the same thing, you know, it's like the story of embryos. Anything that occurs early in development tends to have a major influence. Anything that occurs later in development has less of an influence. And so, as you well know, the malformations that occur early during embryonic development are significant, while the ones later on are a little bit relatively minor. And so in the progressive differentiation of a tooth, you have a balance between directive influences and permissive influences. Directive influences are, in fact, influences that make the cells, the target cells, do something that they would not ordinarily do. So you can take hair papilla cells and put them next to oral ectoderm, and the hair papilla cells might become dental papilla cells. That is a directive influence. You change the pathway of future life for these cells. Permissive influences, on the other hand, are conditions where you allow the cell to continue on to develop in along the pathway that it is already on. And so you can say, well, this cell is going to be an odontoblast in the future, and all it needs is a certain condition in the basal lamina, and it will do just that. And so that is permissive influence. And as you go on during the progressive differentiation that leads to development of a tooth, the directive influences become less, and the permissive influences become more significant. So that is the difference between those two. And it's something to note. This particular, just to show you family relations, Dr. Laurie Saxen is the uncle of Dr. Theslev, so it's a family affair. Okay. Now, when we first started talking about teeth and about inductive interactions. We were still working at a very crude level. And essentially, the first questions were, why do we get teeth and why do we not get a hair or a nail? It's a legitimate question. It is an ectodermal derivative. Why does it not form another ectodermal derivative? What is telling it to do so? And what we did early on was to separate with some trypsin, which enzymatically digests the basal lamina, we separated out the epithelium from the underlying mesenchyme. So you got the epithelium without mesenchyme and the mesenchyme without the epithelium. And when we did it at the placodal and bud stages, what happened was when you then recombined the tooth epithelium with other mesenchyme, you got a tooth or a tooth-like structure. That's what the plus stands for. So that's interesting. However, when you took tooth mesenchyme from that same stage and combined it with any other epithelium, no such thing happened. So in this early phase, it seems that the epithelium is in the driver's seat. The epithelium directs. You take dental epithelium, combine it with other mesenchyme, you have a directive influence that causes the other mesenchyme to start behaving as dental mesenchyme. You take other epithelium, like hair epithelium, you combine it with that same dental mesenchyme, that dental mesenchyme may become hair mesenchyme, for example. Okay, if you take it from a future hair-forming area. So in the early stages, it is the epithelium. But in the later stage, in the, say, cap stage, for example, if you now separate the two out and you take this epithelium and you combine with another mesenchyme, absolutely nothing happens. The tooth does not develop. On the other hand, if you take the dental mesenchyme of this stage and you combine it with what otherwise would be a very different epithelium, it will form a tooth-like structure. So the first thing that we found was that in the early stage, it's the epithelium that determines whether you're going to get a tooth. At later stages, the mesenchyme takes over. And then we went on and looked at some other things and say, why do we get a molar and why not an incisor? And as we will see, we will now we have, in fact, very specific field conditions where you can get gradients of fibroblast growth factor 8 and bone morphogenetic protein 4. And depending on how these two antagonists interact, you can have stronger and less strong fields. And essentially, what we find is that there is a transcription factor that is unique for molars. Barks 1, unique for molars. And if you reduce bone morphogenetic protein in the area of the incisor tooth, you can in fact change the expression of Barks, this transcription factor, and the incisor becomes a molar tooth. So here we have a situation where the balance of two antagonists will lead to expression of different transcription factors. Left and right differences essentially has not been addressed yet. Mesiodistal difference have not been addressed yet. So the important thing of all of this that we found was that there is, in fact, a limited window of time for tissues to respond to these signals. So there is only a very small amount of time. You cannot take ectoderm from your foot sole in an adult and compare it with dental mesenchyme and get ingrowth of epithelium. It won't happen. Okay, there is a limit to how long these tissues can respond. Now, what are the potential mechanisms for interaction? Three have been proposed, and we know for sure that the first and the second occur in dental development. This may not. We don't know yet. So what are these mechanisms? Well, one is that cell type number one, which in this case we'll call the epithelium, produces a freely diffusible substance, bless you, so a small diffusible molecule that can migrate over a good distance to where responding cells are located, and that is therefore a mechanism that really does not depend on the close proximity of cells. The cells can be a considerable distance apart. A second mechanism is a mechanism where there is a extracellular matrix, frequently in the form of a basal lamina, but it is still considered extracellular matrix. And in that extracellular matrix, cells, again, cell type number one, which are the epithelial cells, deposit materials that are not diffusible, that stay within that basal lamina. And then these cells that are close by can now make contact with that extracellular matrix and now can start developing in a particular way. So this is matrix-induced interaction. And again, the matrix can be changed by one cell type to get the target cells to respond in a certain way. The final possibility is cell-to-cell interaction. So this is cell matrix, and this is cell to cell. And that requires that in the case of dental structures, the basal lamina breaks down, and that through the openings, the cells are actually making contact, and they can do that by cell adhesive molecules, or in fact by gap junctions, and some message can be transmitted. So those are the three possibilities. Now let's look at what we find. Diffusible substance. I actually wrote it down already. Okay, nice. Forgotten that I had made that. Okay. Now let's look at the diffusible substances. They are small signaling molecule. They can move over large distances and they can then create fields. And that is something interesting. Let's look at what a field amounts to. Suggest that cell one here, one of the epithelial cells, produces this diffusible substance. This diffusible substance now can move to adjacent cells in one of two ways. One is to have a passage, once it gets out of the cell, the substance now goes into the intercellular areas and passively diffuses. But as it diffuses, at each cell that it encounters, some lysosomal activity will take place that breaks down some of that substance so that the substance gradually degrades over time. You have a gradient. It's strong here, but it gets far less over here. So that is what is known as a field. You have a field where there is a variable strength of the substance. In the case of so-called planar transcytosis, the signal doesn't go in the intercellular spaces, but is taken up by adjacent cells, again to be broken down, and then it will be transmitted to the adjacent cell, more broken down. First of all, it tends to go slower. Secondly, the breakdown is faster, so the field is much smaller. These are two possibilities. We suggest that we have this one right here. And here is what, in fact, produces the field. And what is really happening here is this is a cross-section. This is pharyngeal arch number one, okay? And you're having a coronal cut through it, so you see the two mandibular halves are looking at you. And these two mandibular halves is the area of oral epithelium. And this area of oral epithelium, as it indicated by the color code, is producing fibroblast growth factor 8, okay? And that fibroblast growth factor 8 keeps certain transcription factors from expressing themselves. As you can see here, goosecoid is not being expressed. That stays in the bottom half. And that is where the skeletal elements form. But certain homeobox genes, the limb family, especially 6 and 7, there are two of them, are in fact being expressed by the mesenchyme that now is guided in this direction. So the neurocrest cells, under the influence of fibroblast growth factor, begin to express these transcription factors, these formed by these homeobox genes. And these cells now are guided to the area underneath the epithelium. There are other factors involved, and we really do not want to talk about. Basically, all of these factors, all of the families, are involved. Wingless fibroblast growth factors, transforming growth factor beta 2, even EDAR, that is the receptor for ectodysplasin. Ectodysplasin is critical for tooth development, but it's still somewhat of an enigma as precisely how. And Sonic Hedgehog is also being involved. Now, Sonic Hedgehog is what is shown here. That is being expressed here with these red arrows, and all of these families are actually increasing the level of Sonic Hedgehog just in this area. Surrounding the area, bone morphogenetic proteins and transforming growth factor beta 1 are stopping any further expression of Sonic Hedgehog. So Sonic Hedgehog is specifically limited to the site of the dental epithelium. It's a small thing. I just want you to be aware that there are lots of little activities that limit this. But here, this is important. Yeah. If there's anything that you really have to remember, this is what you absolutely must remember. Fibroblast growth factor 8, as you can see, from here to here is present, and this is now in the case of a mouse, and from here to here is present, all the way to the back. And under the influence of fibroblast growth factor 8, a certain transcription factor is activated that is known as PAX9. Now, PAX9 is essential for tooth development. PAX9, together with another one, MSX1, they kind of co-localize, and those two are essential for the development of teeth. So wherever you have fibroblast growth factor, you find that there is a field of PAX9 and MSX1 being developed. But in some other areas, over here and over here, there is a mixture of fibroblast growth factor and bone morphogenetic protein 4. And that is the direct antagonist of fibroblast growth factor 8, and because of the presence of BMP4, even if some FGF8 is formed, PAX9 is not being formed, and so these are areas where there is no tooth. Okay, and as you know, a mouse and a rat have incisors, but they don't have anything between the incisors and the molar teeth. That's the area in between where you have this mixture of those two. And then there is another area over here where BMP2 is being expressed. It too tends to inhibit PAX9 over here, and so it is the anteroposterior extent of the dental mesenchyme is being limited that way. Now, this, of all the things that I can tell you, this is important. We now know that someone who does not have PAX9 developing, in fact, shows agenesis of teeth. I mean, that it's that direct. So that is something that we need to know about other way. All right. And then what is going to happen, and this now, again, is just for your information. You're not responsible for this individual path. But what you have to understand is that as the development occurs, there is continuously a balance between signals and between antagonists of the signals. And so here, what you're finding is that in this placodal bud stage, wingless is being expressed, and noggin is being expressed. Now, noggin is the antagonist of wingless. It prevents bone morphogenetic protein from forming, and it then that interferes with the formation of this transcription factor LEF1. Now, if you have noggin not forming, you can. I'm sorry. Let it go. That was another track of my thoughts. There's a lot of thought going on. Okay. What you find is that wingless is involved in the stimulation of beta-catenin, and if it acts on LEF1, which normally stops the cat hearing, you can now reduce the amount of cell-to-cell attachments, and as a result, the cells can start to undergo mitosis and start moving around within this mass of epithelium. So here again, the result of decreased cell adhesion is the ability of the cells to start forming different shapes within the epithelium, which is very necessary. Okay. This was, again, just telling you that there is this constant checks and balances going on. What we have here are three different stages that are indicated. Initiation stage, bud stage, and cap stage. And we already have talked about the presence of Sonic Hedgehog here. We have talked about the presence of BMP4 and fibroblast growth factor 8. And we see that in the case of both of these antagonists, MSX1 is being formed. So MSX1 is being formed by both. That's not an antagonistic activity. But what you do find is that FGF8 leads to the expression of PAX9, while BMP4 prevents it and BMP2 prevents it. So if those two are around, you cannot get FGF8 to do what it is supposed to do. That we have talked about. Now we're going a little bit further, and we find that there is a series of interactions between the mesenchyme now, coming from the mesenchyme, going to the epithelium. And specifically, what you find is that BMP4 now affects the epithelium and will start to slow down the fibroblast growth factors, and another set will go on. And in the end, what you get is this particular area, this enamel knot, in the cap stage. Now, that is critical. In the cap stage, the enamel knot is the prime signaling center. And the prime signaling center now is producing from the epithelium to the mesenchyme signals that lead to proliferation in the mesenchyme. Also signals that lead to proliferation of the epithelium on the site, but at the same time, inside is not, there are signals that are generated inside it that are leading to apoptosis. So there is apoptosis in that very signaling center, which directs everybody else to proliferate like crazy. The apoptosis is taking place in that signaling center. But as a result, you get the cap stage formation, the outgrowth of the epithelium, the formation of a distinctive shape of the tooth. Now let's look at these morphogenetic fields, because they now come in here. And what you're seeing here is that during development in the maxilla and in the mandible, morphogenetic fields are established. Now, you probably already have heard a little bit about the variation of the different morphology of teeth, and you know that in general the central incisor is more stable, but there is more variation in the lateral incisor. The same thing is true for premolars. The first premolar is more stable than the second one. And so what you see, when you see these triangles, what you get is that the greater height here reflects the fact that there is more variation. And so the same pattern holds for premolars, molars. It holds for premolars and molars in the lower jaw, but it's just the opposite in the incisors of the mandible, where the greater variation occurs in the central incisor and not so much in the lateral incisor. So there are these fields. And how do these fields get determined? As I told you, these fields are determined by the interaction of fibroblast growth factor 8 and bone morphogenetic protein 4. And essentially there are these different gradients, and the different gradients will in fact establish unique conditions at different sites along the dental arch. And what you're seeing here in this interesting diagram, which starts with the incisor region here and ends up with the molar region here, you see how, because of these different fields, different interactions between these components will lead to expression of MX, MSX1 and MSX2 in the incisor area. And then when you go a little bit further into the back, you get barks, DLX1 and 2 over here. And so the point is that there are these different kinds of expressions of transcription factors, which seem to have a guiding action on what particular tooth is going to be formed. And the most important thing that you have to know is, because that's really what we know most about, and we really don't know a whole lot about the others, is that Barks 1 is essential for molar tooth development. So when you have a particular condition that calls forth Barks 1 as a transcription factor, it is important for the formation of molar teeth. And as I told you, if you change the conditions in the incisor region, so that instead of MSX1, MSX2, and ALX3, they are what you're going to find is that if you prevent those from forming and increase the formation of barks here, you get molar teeth in this area. So the molar tooth morphology really seems to be pretty much under the influence of this particular transcription factor. How it works is still pretty much an open question. So here is that primary enamel knot. Primary enamel knot that you're seeing here in the middle of that cap stage enamel organ. It literally produces all of these various growth factors, sonic hedgehog, bone morphogenetic proteins of a variety, wingless, fibroblast growth factors. Literally all of the major families of signaling factors are being produced in this primary enamel knot. And then we are going crazy. And what you're seeing here is from my colleague Irma Teslev, who actually has a website, biteithelsinki.finland. And she's, of course, in deep mourning today after the miserable loss of the Finnish team, but that's not important. What you find here is that she has set up this site and allows her colleagues to put in information on growth factors and on transcription factors on developing teeth as they find them. And so this is a continuously modified website where you find these different presence of different transcription factors at each case and see how they affect the development of teeth. It's worth looking at, and when you see it, you say, oh my God, it is so complex, don't worry about it. But what this particular diagram does, it shows you for each individual stage what growth factors are involved on the epithelial side and on the mesenchymal side. And over here, it shows you that each of the critical transition stages from one to the next, what the mutants would tell you. What you have, for example, if MXX1 and PAX9 do not form in a given mutation, you cannot go from butt to cap. I mean, and so you can look at each one of them and see how critical these various transcription factors are. The other thing that I just want you to know is that after the cap stage and the early bell, in the case of molar teeth, you have multiple enamel knots. These are secondary enamel knots that form on each of the individual cusps of the forming molar tooth. So the story that you're getting is that this is a very complicated affair. Now, what I've so far dealt with are diffusible substances. Now we go to the problem of cytodifferentiation, where things are a little different. As you will recall, cytodifferentiation occurred, and you had a situation where you have preodontoblast here starting to form, and then you have preameloblast here, and then odontoblast will form. They start producing dentin, and then secretory ameloblast. Okay? So that is what I mean. These are the stages of cytodifferentiation that we now are going to look at. First thing that you find again is that there are, in fact, interesting effects going on, and here Sonic Hedgehog seems to be in charge of this gradient of incisal to apical development. And in the normal tooth, and that is what you see in the top page here, you're seeing all these little dark dots with the green, these are the areas where Sonic Hedgehog is being expressed. And essentially what you find is these cells produce their own Sonic Hedgehog, and then they continue on, and while they continue on, they proliferate. And whenever you see happy faces here, like here, the proliferation takes place, so, you know, happy activities. But once these cells are beginning to differentiate, the little faces are becoming unhappy, and they are now post-mitotic. So, I'm telling you, this is a crazy field. Okay, so here you have the periodontoblasts are still happy, and now here they are post-mitotic, and they are unhappy. Essentially, what you're seeing here is if you block the receptor for Sonic Hedgehog, and the cells can still produce Sonic Hedgehog, but there is no longer a receptor that can deal with it, these cells will become post-mitotic, but they will not form ameloblasts. So the ameloblasts, in order for the ameloblasts to go on, they need Sonic Hedgehog, but that's something intrinsic. But now let's look at the cell extracellular matrix interactions. Here we have a situation where signaling molecules, which we now will describe as ligands, are deposited by the cells that produce them in the extracellular matrix, which is, for example, the basal lamina, and then membrane receptors on the target cells bind to these ligands. How is that being tested? The test is done with the original experiment, and it's one that is very much worth the attention, was done with nucleopore filters. Now, what are nucleopore filters? They tend to be roughly filters of about 10 micrometers in height, and this is a section through it. And there are a series of channels through these filters, and these channels are of predictable width. They are controlled diameters. And so you can go and you can buy a nucleopore filter with 0.1 micrometer pores, or with 0.2 micrometer pores, or 0.3, whatever you want, you can purchase. And then what you can do is you can take two groups of interacting cells and put them on either side of this filter. For example, here neurocrest cells can be put here, epithelial cells can be put here, and then you're going to look and see what happens. And what you're seeing is that if the filters, the pore diameters are of a certain size, you can actually get the cells to grow in their little cell processes and make contact with the cells on the other side. And that is very nicely proven. We can actually determine that when you have nucleopore filters with pore size larger than 2 micrometer, you have these little cell processes. So this is a cell process sticking out. This little end bulb here is a traumatic end bulb. When you take the nucleopore filter and take it out of the dish and you pull a cell process that was attached to the dish, it makes this little round thing here. That's an artifact. So that is a traumatic end bulb. But the point is you can see this little cell process coming through this pore. Now, if you do that in the case of the developing teeth, if you start out with a filter like this, here is the filter, and you see this white area, and you see that you can put mesenchyme on this side, and you can put epithelium on this side, and now you're going to watch and see what happens. If it is pore size larger, smaller than 0.2 micrometers, what you find is that nothing happens. There's no growth across here. However, when the pore size is larger than 0.2 micrometers, you see this. And what do you see here? Well, you started out like this, and you went to that. And what did you get? You got odontoblast, you got predentin, you got dentin, you got pre-ameloblast, and you got even a little bit of ameloblast and enamel. The dark stuff here, over here, that is enamel matrix. Okay? So, in just by changing the pore size and by allowing cell processes to grow across, you get all of the normal cytodifferentiation stages that you find in real life. So this is a fantastic thing. So, what happens in that interface between epithelium and mesenchyme? Basal lamina structure, as you all know, is a rather complicated one. We have a lamina lucida and a lamina densa, and this is a pars reticular fibroreticularis rather. There are little extensions coming from here, and there are anchoring fibrils and all. So this is a very complicated structure. But this basal lamina is known for us as the extracellular matrix. And now you have epithelial cells here, and these cells are producing much of that basal lamina. And the argument is that the structures that are being produced have the right message for the odontoblast differentiation. Here you find the typical components. These are the tetramers of type 4 collagen, and they form a network of cords, very nice. And this collagen then combines with laminin, which forms another network that kind of attaches onto it. Fibronectin is on it, and heparan sulfate proteoglycan kind of gets tucked on that, and it has also attached in it some transforming growth factor beta 1. The question is, what happens here? When odontoblasts are in the process of being induced to differentiate, they do this. They attach themselves to the extensions of the basal lamina. These basal lamina extensions, they're long. Process is sticking out from the basal lamina. Epithelial cell is here, and you notice that here and here, the odontoblast is, and here also, is making contact with that basal lamina. And the same thing is true here. This is in the epithelial root sheet. There's a little bit more gaps between the epithelial cells. Here, the epithelium is on the other side. The preodontoblast is here. And again, here you see, cells makes multiple contacts with the basal lamina. Here's the lamina densa. Here the fibrillar extensions. So there's something there. There is a message being given. And if you look at a higher power and you stain for certain things, what you find is structures that are known and described by some people as basotubules. That's what these extensions really are. And that on these basotubules, if you stain for it, fibronectin is present. So now we have cells contacting fibronectin and the basal lamina. Basal lamina also containing transforming growth factor beta. As we are looking at this particular picture here and seeing the sequence of development of the preodontoblast to become the odontoblast, what you're noticing is this particular kind of thing. These are actually the indications of the size and the presence of fibronectin. So fibronectin is important. Is the only thing, or is there something else going on? At some point, the people who were hot in pursuit of the material that might be important for odontoblast differentiation thought it was transforming growth factor beta. A month later, after publication, they retracted it. It, in fact, is not demonstrated. Let me tell you one thing. You can take a basal lamina from any location, and if you put it next to dental papilla cells, they will become odontoblast. So the basal lamina does not have to be specific dental basal lamina. And so what we are thinking at this point, this is a highly permissive interaction, and the permissive interaction amounts to the fact that you have a basal lamina to which odontoblast, preodontoblast rather, can attach through the presence of fibronectin, and that's really all you need for the odontoblast then to differentiate and start forming dentin. You don't need the preamyloblast on the other side. All you need is the preamyloblast having produced the basal lamina, but after that it becomes a matrix, cell matrix type of interaction. So that is as far as we go with the odontoblast. Now the final thing. Here, cell interactions, question mark, between odontoblast and preamyloblast. Well, here is what happens. When the odontoblast starts secreting dentin, the basal lamina begins to fall apart into little bits and pieces. And the basal lamina now has gaps. And through that basal lamina, you can get long odontoblastic processes that stick in between and form close-looking contacts with the surrounding preamyloblasts. This is another view. This happens to be the epithelium again. And you see that you can have epithelial extensions going to the odontoblast as well as the odontoblastic processes going to the amyloblast. Is there actually a contact? This is the situation that we are looking at. So is there a contact between one cell type and the other? The question is one that is not answered. There are, in fact, if you look closely, you can find connexin 43 presence in fairly large amounts on the two surfaces of the cell membranes of the preamyloblast and the odontoblast that face each other. And so there is the possibility of formation of gap junctions there. But whether they actually form it or whether they're just connections that are not really making contact, there is no real data at this point to say either way. So what we have, the fusible substances are involved in morphodifferentiation, forming fields and determining where the teeth form, determining the shape of the teeth, and so that is all very, very clear. Cell extracellular matrix interactions, definitely the cytodifferentiation of odontoblast, possibly also the cytodifferentiation of amyloblast. Direct cell-to-cell contacts, totally unproven, but there might be something there in the cytodifferentiation of amyloblast. At this point, we have only stayed inside the crown. There is not a whole lot of work that has been done on the roots. People are beginning to look, but they haven't really done a whole lot of work. And so that's where we are today, people. It is an interesting field, and it keeps a lot of us very busy and very active. Now, we are going to the 17th floor, and at 2:30, or are we on to 2:15?
Just go up.
Okay, so go up right now, and Dr. Yuan will give you his session.
Okay. Well, because next one is review, and I finished earlier for them.
Okay, I'm always...